Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Catherine Young, Investment Director at Fidelity International, joins us again from Hong Kong. It's been a few months since we last spoke with Catherine, and today she looks at Asia's economic recovery, specifically rising inequality, geopolitical tensions, and policy responses, among other key factors. Catherine also reflects on the year so far and shares with host Pamela Ritchie what investors should look for throughout the rest of 2020. 1. The flattening of the COVID curve. 2. The pace and sustainability of the economic recovery. And 3. Policy response and policy implementation. Commentary surrounding COVID-19 and financial markets changes frequently. Today's podcast was recorded on August 6th, 2020. And I'd just like to remind everyone, if you'd like to follow more Fidelity content, our show, The Upside, is available on YouTube. It's an investor-focused webcast hosted by Emily Ananuevo, and this week's episode for August 13th is called Best Practices in Investing During Turbulent Times, featuring another Fidelity International Investment Director, Tom Stevenson. Tom explains how investors can stay resilient during market fluctuations and protect their portfolios during tough times, so please visit Fidelity Canada's YouTube page to view. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Catherine, welcome. Great to have a chance to speak with you.
Hi, Pamela. Always good to see you.
We're very pleased you could join us here today. I wonder if we can do a little bit of going back over some of the points that we checked in with you on, you know, a couple of months ago now. You were looking at sort of some three key prongs to keep an eye on, that investors need to keep an eye on for 2020. Are they the same? Can you take us through those?
Yes, they definitely remain the same. So these three drivers include the flattening of the COVID curve, the sustainability and pace of an economic recovery, and then very importantly, policy response and policy implementation. So if we look at China and taking that first prong or driver, then the flattening of the COVID curve itself has been relatively successful. We have had a couple more flare-ups in the mainland. They have been very well contained in general. So the tracking, the monitoring, the containment, they're all up very successful. The healthcare system, again, it doesn't, from our perspective, we don't feel it's going to be as stressed like it was during the first half of the year or indeed the first quarter. Worth pointing out, Pamela, that in fact a mainland team has arrived now in Hong Kong to help build another makeshift hospital here out at our expo center, as well as to help with, again, the tracking and monitoring of the third wave that we're experiencing in Hong Kong.
It's very interesting. And on the policy response, it's been quite a different, I mean, now that we're sort of a couple of months into this and we're realizing what the Federal Reserve has done on policy, what governments around the world have been coming together on the fiscal side of things, just remind us of China's approach, which has managed to be quite different.
They have indeed been bucking the trend. So from an economic recovery perspective, we did see a better than expected GDP number. PMIs are going up nicely, utilization rates, they've been back to normal since about April, May. Many companies' earnings across different sectors have beat on the upside. However, when you look at the exports component or the sector here, still a lot of question marks because, you know, just because Chinese demand has recovered doesn't mean the rest of the world demand will go at the same pace. So given all this, the policymakers appear to have this wait and see approach still. So very different to, for example, 2008, when you saw all that stimulus being thrown into the market. There's a lot of liquidity still, but having said that, policy-wise, you know, they're being very cautious, tweaking around the edges. But what is really interesting, and it's coming through even more and more now, is there's a new phrase you know, Chinese officials like to have phrases, the Made in China 2025 strategy, etc. And this new one is, it's called dual circulation. And it's becoming even more spoken about in the Chinese state press. And essentially, the messaging behind this is that we have to see the domestic economy pick up. We have to see consumption being the key driver of GDP. Don't forget, it was 60% in terms of its contribution, consumption and services last year, towards growth. And as a result, whilst we have that, we also need to make sure that we have an adequate supply chain. And again, this is probably due to some of the rising geopolitical issues we are seeing.
It's so fascinating. And as you say, the sustainable recovery comes into whether we're sort of through the bounce back in various parts of the world. And China is looking at whether it's an area of more sustainable types of growth rates, for instance. Bring the geopolitical in there for us, Catherine, because it's obviously an awful lot of headlines here in North America. And which parts do we need to filter out? Is it all just heading towards a U.S. presidential election?
Over the short term, we are probably going to see an escalation of negative Chinese rhetoric. And so at times you could see the market see or experience volatility. Although having said that, the markets have been relatively robust. Again, what's interesting, I mean, if we move away from the trade discussions stemming from about 2.5 years ago, what's happened now is, you know, whether it's certain companies are being penalized or singled out as a result from a Chinese side or Chinese perspective, you're seeing a lot of companies that were previously listed in the US either have a dual listing in Hong Kong or China. Or Chinese companies actually saying, you know what, there's so much liquidity now and this growing investor base, and in fact, we don't need to go offshore to list. We'll list, again, either the mainland or Hong Kong.
It's so interesting. So that liquidity, there is always a question mark. Is that here to stay, as you say? I mean, there's been quite a lot of IPO action in the Chinese markets lately. Are there examples there that sort of point to this, as you say, kind of dual strategy?
Well, again, when we look at sort of how the markets behaved, and the A-share Chinese market's been one of the best performing markets year to date, foreigners have been interested in the Chinese market, but also that growth of the domestic investor base. So we saw record number in terms of mutual fund issuances over July. We've seen private fund management, like high net worth products, being launched in the market as well. So very popular. Institutional players, etc. So that's provided a level of support. And then going back to your IPO question or your point, you know, we have a number of bourses or exchanges when we look at Greater China. So Hong Kong Stock Exchange, obviously a very well-known and established exchange. We have Shenzhen, we have Shanghai. And then also within Shanghai and Shenzhen, we have two bourses, which sort of like a NASDAQ bourse. So a lot of the tech companies, the biotech names here, I want to list. And one of them being the Star Bourse, so it's a science and technology bourse. The other one being Chinex. And they've both been very, very popular. So the Star Bourse only celebrated its 1 year anniversary last month. And, you know, we've seen about 150 plus companies all participate in terms of IPOs. And some of the names have done incredibly well in terms of when they come to market. And in fact, Ant Financial, which is the financial services arm of Alibaba, they are now looking to announce that they're going to a dual listing in both Hong Kong and on the Star Bourse.
It's very, and some people are comparing or making the comparison of the Star Bourse to the NASDAQ. It's tech heavy, as you mentioned. It's got some of those elements to it. One of the trends that actually you and I spoke about last time was this trend of e-commerce. It's being discussed a lot, but the trend generally has been brought forward. People have been launched into it in a new way. In China, in Asia, there's been a little bit of an element of a leapfrog where e-commerce and forms of payment haven't really had to deal with a legacy banking system that is still there. Can you just discuss what sort of other propulsion or what kind of advantage that gives?
So the internet penetration in China is massive and has been massive even before the COVID outbreak. Although companies in about May, April time were telling us that the usage has really skyrocketed. In fact, it's probably been brought forward in terms of people buying goods and services online by 3 to 5 years, some companies were actually telling us. So e-commerce definitely here to stay, which is why when you look at a lot of these very well-loved or popular names, You know, you have Meituan as an example, which is what started off as an online food delivery company. It's gone into other segments now, like online hotel bookings and the lower end, coupons, etc. But they're trading at something like 290 times forward PE. But the argument is because there's so much liquidity, because people are using so much of this e-commerce, and it's here to stay, this trend. It's not like the dot-com bubble. You know, what's the difference between 290 and 350 times PE? So that's a real sort of conundrum that investors or our portfolio managers are dealing with, because you have this very narrow growth rally still going on. Yet there are some value names which are delivering on earnings. They're still selling products, but the market is completely ignoring them.
Is there a tipping point there, Catherine? How is it being viewed in Hong Kong by Fidelity? Are there things to get ready for perhaps a tipping point where a growth rally has less legs, and therefore perhaps it's time to move to a more cyclical oriented investment style? How does that get broached?
So the scenario that would see this sort of mean reversion towards a more diversified approach to the market would be simply if central banks globally kind of stopped the liquidity that they're pumping into the system. But you can't see that happening anytime soon. And you can understand why people like these names. You know, with the low yielding or low interest environment we live in, all this liquidity, you know, again, these names are delivering because they're so well used. And so that I can see the popularity. To put it this way, there's a company, it's a Hong Kong listed company. It's a large toy manufacturer. It's been around in terms of its business for over 40 years. And it's a really interesting company in terms of it does a lot of the products for Mattel or toys from Mattel and Hasbro. And then they've taken on promotional toys. So, you know, those toys like in the Happy Meal packs at McDonald's. So they do them now.
Unfortunately, I'm well acquainted with them. Yeah, yeah.
I try not to be, but although it is my search now to make sure that the thesis is intact in terms of this company. They have 25 manufacturing factories or plants in Vietnam. So it's that classic play of people diversifying outside of China, whether it's due to higher incomes, whether it's, you know, geopolitical risks, etc. Their second largest competitor has two factories. Their revenue has been on par with a name like Tencent over the past few years. And Pamela, it's trading at 4x price earnings.
It's very attractive. You know, it seems like a slam dunk, but we're not there yet. Is that the idea?
We're not there yet. Although in July, we did see a bit of a rotation. It wasn't long lived, unfortunately, with cyclical value names. So we're starting to see this cyclical recovery, again, underpinned by some of the policies that are being announced by the PBOC or the Chinese government. We would then expect, so for example, the cyclical value names would be like insurance and brokerage firms. We would then expect to see, if the cyclical rally continued, the defensive value names starting to outperform, i.e. the banks, et cetera, materials, industrials. But this kind of had an abrupt stop. So it's kind of like being defensive in China still means very much skewed to these high growth, either e-commerce related names or biotech names.
Take us through how Fidelity Hong Kong it sort of has its ear to the ground of this, because as you say, it's a subtle shift. When it comes, it'll perhaps be subtle, but then have quite a big impact. I mean, how do you sound out when and where that might be coming?
It's, you know, we have to follow, you know, again, those three drivers in particular, but just being really close to the companies and really making sure that, for example, if you're a portfolio manager who has more of a value style tilt, like Jing Ning, who manages the China fund, you know, really making sure that you're not falling into value traps. So mitigating that risk, really making sure that you're on top of a company strategy and that they're delivering. But unfortunately, as I mentioned, there've been so many times where a name, like an industrial name, has beaten expectations, you know, delivering a very attractive dividend yield. The share price barely moves when this announcement comes out, and a hot pot stock trading 100 times is flying. So those kind of, you know, nuances, I think we have to be very careful of. But having said that, you know, we still believe that across the Chinese story, you can find value in all sectors, not just, you know, your traditional value sectors like industrials, materials, etc.
Something that people are very focused on is governance. It goes into obviously the ESG as an overall trend. Corporate governance is something that China in particular has has been really working towards for some time. Bring us up to date on where that is, how that fits in, sort of clarity of earnings, that sort of thing. How should investors think about that?
So again, it's a really understanding of the corporates and their strategies. We assess them in all three components of sustainable investing, so environmental, social, as well as governance. So the dividend policy angle has been really attractive. You know, the state-owned enterprises, which a lot of investors don't favor, have been very good in terms of increasing their free cash flow and these promises of dividend payments. So China Mobile, for example, have promised a 6% dividend yield over the next 2 years. Again, China bucking the trend versus many other countries and companies who have suspended their dividends. But it comes back to this sort of societal question. You can't just have, you know, when you think about ESG or sustainable investing in China, it's not just black or white. There's a lot of gray area. And the thing is, you know, can we sit here and say, okay, the value of video sharing on Instagram and think of all that energy that's being guzzled by those data centers has more of a positive societal impact than, let's say, a school in rural China or India that uses electricity via thermal coal? So that's how we like to look at it. It's all about engagement for us. And in fact, we've had a lot of success in terms of engagement with corporates, especially relating to dividend policy. So a lot of companies have taken our advice on in terms of improving their dividend policy. So that's really, really encouraging.
One of the headlines, as you know, around the world is the phenomena of TikTok, and it's getting sort of mired in perhaps being bought and some US policy and so on. It's owned by ByteDance. How well do you know this company?
They've done incredibly well in the domestic market. So the equivalent of TikTok, Douyin in China, is a real earnings driver. And then they also have a news feed. But outside of China, when we talk about ByteDance, it's obviously well known for TikTok. Interestingly, with everything that's going on, you know, the question comes to us, or the question must arise, are you going to devalue in terms of how we look at the stock, the company, given that they will more than likely have to either sell TikTok or close it down? And interestingly, TikTok hasn't been so much of an earnings driver versus the domestic business. And in fact, all the marketing around TikTok has actually seen it a bit loss-making. So it's a little bit like the Alibaba story in terms of Alibaba is becoming so well known, but it's still very much a domestic China story, even though it's an M&A activity around Southeast Asia. The key driver is still very domestic China focused, which of course feeds into, I mentioned earlier, this commitment from the Chinese government in terms of this sort of, real focus on making sure that the Chinese economy is sustainable as well as the supply chains.
It's absolutely fascinating. Are there lessons, Catherine, from China going into this period of this unbelievable virus that we're all living through this time in history, where they, as you say, from the outset, they have contained it well? What are the lessons perhaps from that, but just also from reopening an economy that the rest of the world, I'm sure, is looking to, but we kind of need to be reminded of? What are the lessons?
I guess when you look at China, they're in a fortunate position in terms of with their healthcare system, you know, should there be an outbreak, it's a lot easier for them to transport health workers to that particular province or state or area of the outbreak. So, you know, again, we don't think there's going to be as much stress on the healthcare system as what we have seen in the past. The tracking and monitoring, this even came about when the migrant workers, in fact, returned to the factories in March or with the lifting of the restrictions. And there was really, you know, this diligence on ensuring that there wasn't an outbreak in the factories, because they had all these aims of factory utilization rates, 80, 90%, 100% by April, et cetera. So, you know, South Korea has also been very, very successful in terms of their containment and how they track future outbreaks, et cetera. So I think that's one big lesson. From more of a corporate perspective, you know, ensuring that companies have got free cash flow, ensuring they understand the challenges that we're living in, because we're in a period of significant declining revenues. And then I guess from a policy perspective, the PBOC hasn't thrown everything at the situation. You know, understandably, don't forget China still has this debt situation. So they couldn't do it like another 2008 all over again. But this focus on, you know, what are we good at? You know, we know that we need infrastructure, but it's not just the typical traditional infrastructure like building out the train system, etc. It's more new economy infrastructure. So the 5G rollout, You know, there's been a big push, by the way, a lot of support in terms of China's equivalent of GPS. And so they've created their own navigation system, and the governments obviously underpin this with support. There's a lot of chat at the moment, in fact, with the Chinese actually launching alongside the PBOC, the banks, the fintech companies like Tencent and Alibaba, digital currency. And so that's going to be really fascinating. So it's just sort of like, okay, let's get back to work. Let's forge ahead. You know, nothing goes out in a linear line. I'm not saying that, but we are going to get periods of volatility. You might get some earnings surprise on the downside. Some macro might disappoint. But the key risk still is that, you know, this geopolitical issue at times, although having said that, I think you and I have spoken in the past about how the relationship between China and the U.S. has changed for the long term as China becomes more and more competitive. Again, whether it's a navigation system, whether it's, you know, aeronautics, et cetera, there is this fierce competition now between the two economies.
And it seems to come into every sector. And I wonder, you know, this is the moment to sort of ask about trade, but also just the idea that there's a deglobalization movement. There's also a recalibrating, I think you've said before, of where companies are listed, where they stay, where they work. I mean, can you just discuss that for us, sort of particularly in the Asian region? How should we be watching for or looking at, you know, where things are changed up essentially based on geopolitics, but also the realities of deglobalization to an extent?
Yeah, and the reality of deglobalization is that you have basically a split in the world, and you're already seeing China through the Belt Road Initiative. In fact, there's been some messaging recently come out about the vaccination and the Chinese basically supporting other emerging markets to provide the vaccination. And so it's kind of been dubbed the soft Belt Road Initiative.
Mm. So what was this right? Or that's sort of one headline. Yeah,
exactly. And this sort of ongoing, okay, if, you know, if certain companies abandon the US, we'll sell our brands into other parts of the world, again, Africa, the rest of Asia, Latin America, etc. So it's not a good thing if we see the world sort of deglobalize. It's not a good thing for consumers, by the way, because you can't have one phone in one part of the world, another phone that doesn't work, you know, in that part of the world, etc., etc. But there is this sort of sense of growing patriotism. And even when you look at brands, I mean, you're seeing so many Chinese brands now really compete against the foreign brands and take market share away from them. There are certain foreign brands which are always going to do well in terms of the consumption story in China. But, you know, whether it's fashion related, sports apparel, you know, technology. So there's a company called Momo, which has a live streaming app as well as it's like Twitter, Tinder or Bumble, or it's a dating app, it's called Tantan. So the Chinese have created all these apps, and they can't live in isolation from the rest of the world. But again, there's such an emphasis, which is becoming very pronounced with this dual circulation, probably in response to the anti-China sentiment that's coming through. You know, we are seeing it flare up occasionally.
In terms of an investor, and as you say, it's not great for consumers because things get divided up to an extent, and ultimately there's less competition, which allows various players to charge more. I mean, that's, but from an investor perspective, how is that sort of an advantage that, I mean, Fidelity is there to help with those investments that are exposed to this growth and perhaps larger margins? Can you discuss that?
Yeah, again, it's just making sure you understand the companies and their strategies. And, you know, interestingly, with all these companies who are coming to market, I mean, the IPO pipeline is looking healthy when it comes to Chinese companies. You know, I guess the risk of all these companies competing, in whether it's biotech or e-commerce, is the intensity of competition is massive. And they all kind of morph into each other's spaces. So the winner of today might not be the winner of next year. It's a little bit like luxury brands when they all started going to the Chinese market. And one year Gucci was the preferred brand and dominated market share. And then the next year, all of a sudden, they dropped to number 10 and Louis Vuitton was number one. So it's that sort of, yes, there's enough demand for all these suppliers or service providers. But, you know, when you're paying those kind of multiples that I mentioned earlier, so, you know, 100 times plus, really have to sit there and think, where's my margin of safety? But definitely when you look across our portfolios, our Asian regional portfolios or or China portfolios, the most of the revenue or the sales we are focusing on is driven by domestic demand.
Right. So interesting. Can you tell us a bit more about, we haven't really spoken about other Asian nations to much of an extent in terms of opportunities, and if there is a recalibration where opportunities flow, perhaps India at some point as well we can discuss. But I'm just curious, are there other areas that you're looking to with real interest right now in terms of countries?
It's across countries and sectors, although, you know, again, if we go back to that first driver of the flattening of the COVID curve, China has been very successful. South Korea, as I mentioned, across ASEAN, not as much success. So the Philippines has just put in more restrictions. Singapore had another record day of 900 plus, although that's very much contained with the migrant workers and how they all live together. Indonesia hasn't been as successful again. Thailand's quite interesting. So we're seeing some younger part of the population sort of protest, or there's some unrest there against sort of the government. So what's happened, and you're seeing it around the world, by the way, it's not just singling out Thailand, but because of the situation, because of the lockdown, there's a big divide now between, you know, the wealthy and the not wealthy. And as an example, there was a case where I think he was the heir. Well, you're not, I think he was the heir of Red Bull. And there was a car accident and he was driving in 2012. And the Thai government, he's been on Interpol, right? So he fled Thailand. He's been on Interpol. And it was recently announced that they'd dropped all charges. And that was one of the catalysts for this unrest. And right. So you're seeing a lot of this. You're seeing, you know, again, these economies or countries kind of torn between, you know, geopolitically, which direction they go in. And so there's a lot going on, as well as the COVID situation, the restrictions. You know, Thailand, unfortunately, is so dependent on tourism, and obviously no tourism this year. So it's a real struggle, and that's why, again, if we had to take any lessons away from what happened with China first in, first out, so as to speak, you know, that I guess that flattening of the COVID curve is really important. And then when you do see flare-ups, it's very quickly contained so that the economic recovery can continue, and then policy, again, not throwing everything at the kitchen sink, but just being a little bit more balanced.
It is sort of incredible that it does come down to the virus, because it then follows that the economic recovery obviously can be sustainable, as you say, and we get through the sort of snapback stage and then go with something that is a bit more sustainable. It's always so fascinating to get your views, Catherine. Thank you for sharing your time with us today, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Pamela. Take care.
All the best. We'll see you again soon. It's Catherine Young joining us from Hong Kong.
Thank you for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. For more information on future live webcasts, please visit fidelity.ca. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice.